Welcome to Eric's Perspective. Joining us today is Dr. Bridget Cooks. I'm honored and happy that you agreed to be here today, so thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's great to see you.
And it's great to see you, too. That's the other side of it. I haven't seen you in a little while. Between the pandemic and me moving from my old space to the new space, it's been a little bit of a challenge. So
the world has changed and changed and changed again.
Isn't that something? I mean, it's just kind of incredible. In the beginning, at least, it was a little scary, but it's nice that we're progressing through it.
Yeah, I feel like we're making some progress, and we can sit here without our masks and, you know, not be terrified.
So. Exactly, and I'll just say that, and I heard you say the same thing, I'm fully vaccinated, and anyone listening or viewing, I encourage you, if you haven't already been vaccinated, please do that.
Please get vaccinated.
Because that'll help us all. It's not, it's for you as a person, but it's for everyone else too, so thank you.
Yeah. I know, PSA.
PSA, yeah. Exactly, so... Bridget, I thought we would start by just learning a little bit about you, how you first got started. What was it that got you interested in the arts?
Oh, my gosh. Well, there are so many different beginning points, I think, that kind of culminate and then became, I think this is what I'm going to do with my life. So I'd say one of those things was a very early memory that will date me. Which is going to see the King Tut exhibition at LACMA, which I think was in 76 or 77. And I was a baby. I'm not lying. I really was. And the reason I remembered is because my mom had to hold me up to see down into the cases to see all of the amazing jewelry. Oh. And it made this big impression on me. I remember... It was very crowded, it was very loud, and it was a big deal. Like a group of people from my family, we all went together. And we grew up south of Pico, but, you know, not far from LACMA. And the museum was always a special place, kind of a special occasion to go. And so it had art had a presence in my life. It seemed to be a destination, you know, something that was unique and celebrated. And I went to college at UC Irvine where I teach. Ah. And I went as an art major. I wanted to be a painter. And I bought the biggest canvas I could afford and sat there in front of this, you know, very intimidating blank canvas and realized I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I didn't know really anything coherent about the history of art or painting in particular. So I started taking art history classes, and then I got really seduced by all of the stories of these crazy people cutting off their ear and giving it to a prostitute. And, you know, it was like, what is this? You know, I was raised in the Black church, and I was used to dramatic stories. And then I came to art history, and I was finding, you know, these stories that were epic and really interesting. So I majored in art and art history. And then I realized that we weren't learning anything about Black artists in, you know, the major art history classes. And there were a couple of Black artists, who were at UC Irvine. Pat Ward Williams was there. Ulysses Jenkins, he was hired while I was there. And I knew that there were contemporary African-American artists, but I didn't know anything about what had happened before. Mm-hmm. And so that really encouraged me to pursue art history more, and it helped me feel like there was a place for me because it was a field that was underdeveloped. So that's initially how it started, and from there I went to the University of Rochester. I worked with Douglas Crimp and wrote a dissertation about a history of Black exhibitions, art exhibitions, and also world's fairs. Oh. And so it kind of, yeah, took off from there.
So I have to ask, so you were also majoring in art in the beginning. Are you still an artist? Do you paint?
You know, I think I'm still a creative person. One of the great things about my job is I've as I practice it is I meet a lot of artists and talk to them a lot, spend time in their studios. I write about their work. And I have to say now I'm not an artist because it is a full-time job and you've got to, you know, put the hours in and have the ritual. And I am a writer and a curator and academic, and I can't say that even if I make a painting once in a while, I wouldn't call myself an artist because I'm just not putting in the effort and time that you really have to, you know, be the best at your craft.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I think, at least in my experience in talking with different collectors and individuals and people and so forth, some people might get the impression that if you're an artist, that it's just kind of this frivolous activity. Yet it requires a discipline and investment of time is pretty significant, right? I mean, no matter what the art, it could be visual arts, it could be music, it could be you name it. It's not something you could just kind of all of a sudden go, oh, you know what? I'm suddenly, ding, I'm an artist, boom, and that's it. You just put something on a canvas. And that's the end of the story, right? No.
Yeah, the artists I respect are working full-time, and they have no choice but to be artists. You know, there's something in them, there are things that they want to say, and that's the way that they can express, you know, what they have to offer, their experiences that they've had. So they're always thinking, I mean, for me, as someone who's a writer and a professor, you know, school's out right now. I'm in the middle of grading, but I'm still working. You know, I'm constantly thinking about what can I do better next time, what's going to be interesting to the students. I'm constantly thinking about essay deadlines that I have coming up and what I want to say in those essays. So I think for artists, and probably for people outside of the arts too, you know, if you're really dedicated to your field, you're always working in some way.
Exactly. And that brings me to the point where you're saying, like, you were writing, you're researching, you've written numerous articles.
Yes.
And so forth. So, I mean, that too, like being an artist, I mean, that requires a lot of time and effort. And it's an art in and of itself, I would think.
I think it is. And I feel much more comfortable saying that I am those things. You know, I'm a researcher and a writer and a professor and a curator because I know I put all of the hours in for that.
You could feel it, right?
I feel it. Yeah. And it's hard to relax. It's hard to turn it off and switch and say, I'm going to have some downtime. So that's what's hard for me is the balance. But yes, I'm working at it all the time. And yes, and I do want to talk to you at some point about the Colescott because it's right here. We're not going to be able to ignore the Colescott.
No, we can't. No, this is a piece titled Death of an Old Mulatta.
Oh.
Executed in 1991, excuse me. He passed away in 2009. I was about to tell you his, not to tell you, you already know, but that
he died in 2009.
But yeah, he did it in 1991. It's an interesting piece. You can see Africa there in the face of that one figure to the right, and a lot going on.
Yeah, this is exciting. Yeah, and the whole world map, I see Italy down there.
Yeah, yeah, they got Europe and Africa all in the same painting. That's really, really pretty fascinating.
I'll have to before I leave, I'll have to stand back and get a whole view of it.
Oh no, absolutely. I think it's just a wonderful painting. And I love it greatly.
Yes, I know. I was just looking at those purple curtains, and this is all so theatrical and tragic, you know, sort of with the curtains parted and it's all being delivered in this dramatic way on stage.
That's a good way of putting it. I agree with you totally. It's a very dramatic piece.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Well, good. I'll look forward to spending some time looking at this.
Oh, and I invite you to do that, too. That would be wonderful. And I'm interested to hear what you have to say because it's always fascinating for me to have someone look at a piece and give me their interpretation or some of the things they see because I obviously could overlook something or have a different interpretation. So it's always wonderful to share that kind of thing.
It's so helpful. And that's one of the things that keeps me teaching is because I enjoy so much somehow most of the students do need permission
right.
to say what they think. They're not used to that at all. They want to know what the answer is.
Right.
And that's not what we're doing. So after I can get them past that expectation, then the world starts opening up for them.
Yes.
You know, and I see things that I didn't see before. They see things they didn't see before. There's so much that's generated in those conversations. And
you know, it's fascinating you say that because you're noticing that in your students, but I notice that in a lot of people that come into my gallery.
Yeah.
They're almost ashamed to say that, and they're kind of looking for the, well, so how should I like this piece? You know, and a lot of times they cling to the names like, and don't get me wrong. I mean, these are names that deserve reverence, like Romare Bearden and Jacob Lawrence and so forth. But if there's an artist whose name they've never heard before, and they could even like the piece. I've had this experience with a collector, for example, it's like they're quite comfortable saying they like the piece because they're not sure if I'm going to say to them or somebody else will say to them behind their backs, oh my God, can you believe? They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, it's a shame. Yes, that resonates with me. And it is a shame. And they do feel, I don't know what the insecurity is, that they're going to look like the fool or.
I think that's what it is. And maybe now that I'm talking with you, I mean, maybe it's part of that whole experience of going through school where you're always looking for the answers instead of being looked at as perhaps a source of the answers. Mm-hmm. I remember once it was really interesting. I had this one woman come into my gallery. I had an exhibit of Elizabeth Catlett's prints. Mm. And it was her famous I Am the Black Woman that started out I Am the Negro Woman series. And there's one piece in there. That features Phyllis Wheatley. And so for the longest time, I never paid attention to this. A person comes in, an elderly lady, and she's admiring the whole series. And then she says, well, wait a minute. Isn't that interesting? She looks at the Phyllis Wheatley piece and notices that Phyllis is writing from right to left instead of from left to right. And that seems like a small thing, but I realized that Elizabeth, when she made the lino cut, the actual plate itself, she did it with the proper orientation. But when you lift it off the paper, unless there's an offset medium, it's going to be in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. It's a small thing, but I just realized, you know, she just pointed it out to me. I had never seen, I've been looking at that print for years and never noticed that one little thing before.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed that either.
Yeah, so the next time,
I will definitely see that.
Look at it next time.
And that's something interesting to point out to students of any age if they're not familiar with the process. Because sometimes my students, they'll no matter what we're talking about, they say it's a painting. Oh. And I'll say, it's a photograph.
Right.
And they know it's a photograph, but they say painting as a default. And so I'm trying to teach them the difference between media, you know, and to know the process and how laborious printmaking is, you know, and that's part of what makes that that whole series so wonderful.
Oh, yes.
Is the labor, the pre-planning that goes into each work in that series.
Yes.
All of that needs to be part of the appreciation. So
absolutely. And with Elizabeth, she was so talented at utilizing the features of that medium to reinforce the message, because those lines that you create in a lino cut or a wood cut, you just can't reproduce with a paintbrush or a crayon. It was to make the way I feel about it and the way I look at it, it's like it reinforces the boldness of the statement she's making.
I agree. Yeah, there's something about, you know, it's subtractive, right? So if we think about just her arm muscle, like her body moving and being part of this creation, you know. And it's sharp. You know, you've got to be careful. You have to be deliberate.
Oh, yes.
You've got to plan it out.
Oh, my God. And the slightest relief or increase in pressure could affect the width of the line.
That's right.
So forth. And oftentimes, a lot of people hear the word print and they kind of scoff at it, like it's less than. And I never will forget Elizabeth when I first approached her and she was explaining to me. She says, you know, this is a print, but it's not a print like you might think it is. This is her telling me this. And she's saying, listen, this is an artistic print. This is a print. And she said that with a certain degree of respect mm-hmm. that she wanted the medium to have, because mm-hmm. there's an oxymoron term that I've heard used to describe the method as a multiple original, which is a really okay. kind of interesting thing, because the plate is the original. Obviously, the things that are lifted from it are the copies, but it's not a reproduction, though.
Right.
It's literally from the hand of the artist. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's my long.
No, I think that's wonderful. And I like that she was, I never got a chance to meet her. I saw her once at an opening of a show at CAM, at the California African American Museum.
Yes.
And I just wanted to see her. You know, I didn't have anything smart to say. I didn't have anything to say that she hadn't heard before. Mm-hmm. But it was just so wonderful that she showed up. And to think about the work that goes into the process of making the art, but then also her choices of subject matter,
yes.
and then how ridiculously and unfairly talented she was to be a master printmaker and a master sculptor.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, what is that about? That's how incredible. Do you just, like, claim everything?
That's just so incredible, isn't
and
it?
And just do it.
Isn't that incredible? And the sculptor, I mean, she was able to do with wood and marble similar things that she was able to do with clay, too. So she was, like, very versatile.
Right. And strong.
And strong.
And strong. Yeah. Yeah. She was an incredible artist and very outspoken, very clear.
Oh, yeah.
I know that, you know, she'd made these sculptures of her twin granddaughters, yeah. and one of them just won America's Top Model. And my students were asking me about that, and I said, what are you talking about? And so we went on Google together, and I was, oh, my God, it's Elizabeth Catlett's granddaughter. And
oh
so,
goodness.
Yeah, the Tyra Banks show.
Really? Was that recent?
I think it was before COVID, so two years, maybe 3 years ago.
Okay.
So anyway, the legend is living on, and, you know, great talents in the blood.
And I'm sure she's smiling down on the whole thing.
I'm sure she is. I mean, she knows their faces and their hairstyles.
Oh,
and,
intimately,
you know,
right?
Yeah. So it's great that it is taking on this other dimension, or kind of those images are being dispersed, you know.
Well, moving into your own writings, approximately 10 years ago, I think you wrote the book Exhibiting Blackness.
Yes.
And I was just curious to know first if maybe you can, and I encourage listeners and viewers to get the book and check it out. But
thanks.
If you could tell us a little bit about what prompted you to do it and what were some of the things that you discovered in writing the book. And also, with 10 years having passed, is there anything that you would say now?
So much has happened just in the last 3 years that we could write a whole nother book. But the book is called Exhibiting Blackness, African Americans in the American Art Museum. And it's a look really at the history of Black people and mainstream art museums in America. So thinking about African American artists, security guards, curators, and audiences. And what prompted me to write the book was that I had this whole career in the museum world. I had been an intern at the Oakland Museum, at what now is the National African American Museum of History and Culture. I worked directly with Deborah Willis when it was the African American Museum Project, in I think 1994.
Oh, wow.
Where we worked together with a whole team of people to try to prove to the government that there would be interest in a museum dedicated to African American people. So it was this kind of testing ground in the Arts and Industries Building. I was an intern at the National Gallery of Art, and then I had my first full-time paid job at LACMA. And so I was inspired to write the book in part from my experiences working in all these places as a Black woman. Thinking about the way that I had been treated, the opportunities that I was offered, the privileges I had, and also I was really aware of how much the museum world, I'd say professionals and regular audiences, really didn't know anything about Black artists and were very flustered and dismissive. And so every time we would have a show, for instance, the Rhapsodies in Black, art at the Harlem Renaissance show that happened, I think it was in 97, by Dr. Rick Powell, Richard Powell, and David Bailey. This is a show that happened at LACMA. Mm-hmm. And when that show happened, you know, I'd walk through the galleries and I'd hear people say, you know, I never knew there were any Black artists, or, oh, wow. Well, what else is there? And where did these people come from? And, you know, so I wanted to do that research on, I mean, I knew the history of African-American artists, but I didn't know the history of exhibitions of work by Black artists. And so I wanted to make that history known. So, you know, I don't talk about every exhibition in the book, but I do talk about the first exhibition of art by African-Americans in a mainstream museum, which happened in 1927 in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And then I came all the way up through the decades to the Quilts of G's Bin touring exhibition from 2002. So I think what I've done with that work, in a way, I've created a kind of reference text. I met a couple of years ago, just before the pandemic, I met Amy Sherald, which I was, you know, delighted, and my heart was racing. And someone introduced us, and then she said, and she wrote Exhibiting Blackness, and then Amy looked at me and she said, oh, your book is my Bible.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
She hugged me, and I just, you know,
oh, that must have been
it
wonderful.
Was an incredible moment, and I was like, somebody take a picture. So I have like four pictures of us together, but awesome. You know, it was just, it was great. And she said that she sometimes, before she speaks to an audience or, you know, has to give a talk and she wants to talk about the history, she'll look at my book and kind of, you know, refamiliarize herself with the past and the story that I'm telling, which is our story. So it's really had a life of its own. I've spoken to university audiences, but also museum audiences and directors and curators and a lot of docents who were trying to figure out what to do, how to talk about art. I've had a lot of conversations about what should be in a label for an artwork by a Black artist. Mm-hmm. And done kind of workshop discussions, events with different groups of people. So a lot has happened, yeah, since then, in the last 10 years. I don't think I'm going to write another Exhibiting Blackness, but I have been approached about doing something like that. But there are so many younger people who I think are doing the work and really combining activism a bit more with their demands for how things need to happen now and how they need to go in the future. Mm-hmm. And I think that my work has been more about writing about artists and then curating. So that my next book isn't going to be about exhibiting Blackness, but I do talk a lot about, you know, what do you think about what's going on now and Black Lives Matter and mainstream museums and how they're responding. And I'm happy to talk about that, because I'm just as interested in it now as I was, you know, back then.
So what do you think? I mean, given, because what was it? The Soul of a Nation toured. It was an interesting exhibit. Uh-huh. I really enjoyed it. For example, what did you think of that?
Well, I liked Soul of a Nation. You know, I worked with Frank Wilderson, who's a professor at UC Irvine and an author, and he and I were hired by the Broad to put together this one-day symposium around that exhibition when it was in LA. And it was wonderful to have artists from that era who had works in the show, artists from the era who didn't have works in the show, to talk about what it meant to make art then, where they showed, what kind of encouragement or discouragement they received. We had this wonderful conversation between Ava DuVernay and Darren Walker, and thinking about her projects, how she's able to fund them, the kind of support she gets, the kind of audience that we have now for that kind of work that's different from when it was created in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, it was the most visited exhibition in the Broad's history. There's a lot of interest. You know, things that we might know very well are totally new for people who walk in the door.
Sure.
You know, and I'm thinking about my students. It's like, oh, maybe I won't teach Colescott this year, you know, because I've heard myself say it over and over again over the 20 years I've been teaching. But then I think, yeah, when are they going to find out about Bearden or Colescott or Catlett if I don't say it?
Right.
So there's always new generations who need to know. I always hope, though, that when we have these big shows that they will inspire other people to do smaller, more focused shows that have greater depth. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm hoping that there are scholars who are also going to take up the mantle and say, oh, we need to know more about Richard Mayhew, or we need to know more about Mike Henderson or whoever. And that will just help to deepen deepen the research for African-American artists, but also develop the field even more.
Sure. When you look back on the exhibit, the first one, as you mentioned, in the mainstream in 1927, and maybe contrast that with, a more modern.
Yeah.
What would you say are some of the main differences?
Yeah. You know, that show was so fun to research because Alain Locke, who's considered the author of the Harlem Renaissance, he wrote the New Negro Book from 1925, which is really the Bible of the movement. You know, he was involved with a group of all white women, the Chicago Women's Club, and it was this kind of social work effort to promote black people in arts and culture. It wasn't really seen as a serious art exhibition where the artists would really be considered on par with white artists of the day. And so the call for the artists said pretty clearly, you know, this is an all black show. This is not an interracial show. And that is the history of black artists being exhibited in museums. It's been in a segregated way. So that's number one. And number two, the call said, we're only interested in artwork that matches as closely as possible our standards. And so there was this fear that, oh, if it's black artists, we don't know what we're going to get, you know, and we want the work to look as if a white artist made it.
Ah, I see.
So that, you know, so there were some clear expectations and some anxieties. In anticipation of the work that they were going to get, the Chicago Art Institute, as it was called then, they decided to put the artwork in the children's section of the museum.
Wow.
And then a second part was in a space for the meetings of the Chicago Women's Group. So it wasn't taken seriously.
Kind of symbolic in a way, right?
Very symbolic. And, you know, what they picked, sure, it looked like it could have been made by white artists.
What did they pick? Can you remind me?
They had some tanners in the exhibition. William Harper, I think, had some work in the exhibition. They may have had some, I want to say Edmonia Lewis, but I'm not exactly sure.
Okay.
But it was landscapes. Really, much of it looked quite impressionist. They were dated. They weren't from the 1920s in terms of their style. They weren't really cutting edge contemporary art. It looked like 19th century work.
I see.
So it was something very old fashioned and I think safe about the work that they picked. Mm-hmm. And then they also combined it with African sculpture, which was interesting.
Would that be Alain Locke's influence, perhaps?
I think that's Alain Locke's influence. I don't know how the exhibition looked in the galleries, if they had African art in one place separately from, you know, because it was in two different spaces, or if they had the sculptures kind of interspersed with the fine art, quote-unquote fine art, by the Americans. So, I mean, it was an opportunity for black artists to show their work, to be exhibited at all. I don't think it was in the framework that they may have wanted to present themselves, but there were some requests for the show to travel, but the requests all came from these kind of social work, interracial societies, not from other museums.
I see.
So, yeah, so that kind of set the path for segregation, the all-black shows being in a separate wing, not to be confused with work by white artists, but also you don't want the work to look too different from work by white. So it's just...
That's an interesting dichotomy in a way, right? I mean, it has to kind of conform, and at the same time, it's not a part of.
That's exactly it. I think in those ways, when you're asking about comparing it to where we are now, I think there's still some of that there. You know, we want you to conform. We also want the work to, one thing that maybe is different is there are these expectations of what black art looks like. That black artists, for the most part, are not all that interested in. You know, black artists are artists who want freedom to do whatever they want to do.
Yeah, whatever boils up in them, right?
That's right. But in terms of collectors, museums, and private collectors, there has been an expectation for there to be some kind of performance of blackness in a legible way.
Can you give an example of what that might look like?
You know, I would say so. An artist I really love, his work, and personally, Richard Mayhew, has had a different kind of reception by mainstream museums because he makes these kind of psychedelic colored landscapes. There aren't any black people in the work. Mm-hmm. And so he's largely not embraced as a black artist or someone who makes black art. So he's been left out in some ways of collectors' ideas of what they should be collecting to prove that they believe that Black Lives Matter or that this is a democracy and everyone should be included based on merit. In his career, I mean, he was part of Spiral, and which was a collective of Black artists in the 1960s who originally organized to be part of the March on Washington and decided that they would have an exhibition of artwork where all of the art was black and white, the colors black and white, and that this was going to be their way as artists to participate in the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And he did a landscape, no people, you know.
Even at that time.
Even in that show, mm-hmm. Yeah. So in those, if looking at Richard is an example of sort of being inside and outside, you know. I see. He's also someone that is very open about his Native American heritage. Mm-hmm. And I think being of mixed race in a way has also made him an insider outsider. I see. So, so there's some diversity there that isn't easily classified mm-hmm. as black art. But, you know, so many black artists, they're all individuals. They all make their own world.
Sure.
They all have their own perspective, but I think in terms of the history of art exhibitions, the lines have to be very clean and distinct. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we're really getting out of that or not. I think it's a different moment.
I see. We should say, by the way, that Richard Mayhew is still with us, right? he's in his 90s?
I think that he is 97 this year.
Okay.
And he paints every day.
Wow.
The last time I saw him, I did an oral history with him and the Berkeley Oral History Center for the Getty, and he was still driving to my concern.
No way.
I was going to say dismay, but it was a little bit more than that. I was like, you want me to drive? You know. But, he's doing well.
Well, that's good to hear because Richard, I had the good fortune of having some of his work, but him also in my gallery, so... I know him somewhat.
Yes. I remember seeing, maybe I saw some prints
Yes.
In the gallery.
So, we have a few etchings and a couple of paintings, too, we have.
Oh, great.
Too, that fit the description you just made there.
Yeah.
The really interesting landscapes involving trees and mm-hmm. hills and so forth.
I think about his work, you know, people will say black art has to be political and, you know, not all black artists want to be overtly political. They don't need to make paintings that say Black Lives Matter, you know.
Right.
But the politics can be there in a different way. I think about his work as being peaceful.
Right.
And escapist, I think, in the best way possible. You know, in times of conflict, in times of violence, you know, that his paintings are suggesting where we could be. Yeah. Or maybe a way, as a real place, or as an imagined landscape, or as a kind of inner landscape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like an aspirational place where we want to be.
Oh, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
And to me, that's political, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, you know, it reminds me, and I'm going to probably butcher this a bit, but someone was describing to me a piece that Edward Bannister did.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the location, a favorite location, I think, of Frederick Douglass or something like
okay.
that. Okay. And, you know, without knowing that, if somebody telling you that, it's not obvious in the painting itself, and yet it was almost a way of paying tribute to one of the great historical figures who was very political, very right. anti-slavery person, right?
So that's right.
To your point, I mean, there's a way to do that without being sort of vociferous or...
Right. Yeah. I agree. And, you know, and Bannister was very outspoken about his politics and being an abolitionist. And he wanted Black audiences and he wanted Black collectors, you know. And I see that, you know, it's not the same thing, but there's a way in which the art does one thing and then the politics of the person does something else.
Mm-hmm.
And just the audacity to say, I am a Black man and a landscape painter. I'm a Black man and I paint in abstraction, mm-hmm. you know. It's like, in a way, that's a way of standing up and saying, I'm going to claim the freedom that it says I have on paper.
Yes.
I'm just going to live out that truth.
Yes.
You know, that to me is political.
No, absolutely.
So.
And here he is. He's a 19th century artist. And I remember David Driscoll pointing out that he undercover submitted a painting to a contest and won. And the judges had no clue that it was done by a Black person. Probably had they known, he wouldn't even been able to be in the contest at all.
Right.
But it was pretty significant.
And then he wasn't allowed to receive the prize.
And he wasn't allowed
once to receive he showed up. And that's not an uncommon story. Lois Mailou Jones, she had white male allies, and she would say, submit this under your name
mm-hmm.
to see if she would win or not. And in one case, I know for sure she did win. So, and they say, well, we'll mail the prize or, you know, we'll just don't show up, you know.
Right.
We don't want to see you.
That's just an incredible thing to consider.
I know.
The history of it.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, over the generations. Yeah.
And it seems like those attitudes die very, very hard, it seems.
And,
you
know,
and you would think in the art world, I mean, it's got this association of being liberal, people wearing earrings in their hair long and have unusual spellings of their names and so forth, that would be the last place you would find this sort of attitude. And yet it seems in many ways it's stronger there than any other part of society.
I know. I agree. And, you know, I think in some ways I was a misfit. In a lot of ways I was a misfit child. And I think... First, I studied animal science. I went to North Hollywood High School because they had a zoology magnet. And I was a misfit among other misfits who kind of were awkward and related more to animals than people. I think going into the arts, it was that same kind of thing. It's like, let me go there and that's where I can figure myself out, meet other weirdos, make cool things, you know, be right. in the studio all night. Listen to great music, you know, travel the world in a way, you know, through the study. But now, having been in the arts for so long, it's clearly corporate work. You know, you really have to find your people and hold on to that magic that got you into the business in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And I do find that with artists. I mean, I often become friends with artists because we're able to meet each other in a beautiful space of world making and magic and history and reality.
Mm-hmm.
somehow in that chemistry, then you become bonded, you know. But yes, it's a business. And but the academy, you know, I work for the state of California. It's a business. So it's disheartening, but then you also just figure out, if this is how it works, how can we get some of the magic in there, you know, while we're doing the business.
Right. You know? One thing that pops into my head when you were talking about the art from the 1927 had to kind of look a certain way. So for them to feel safe. It reminded me also of David Driscoll's point about this book written in the 60s. And his quote that he pulled out, the book, it said something like, you know, black people can appreciate art. It's just their problem is they can't produce it.
Right.
And then it went on to explain in greater detail why that was the case. And their theory was because the black person was just infatuated with black people. And so the problem was, it was just too much focus on themselves as black people. And I just found that so incredible, you know, to think about. This was a book in the 60s. And it's just sort of the opposite, you know, instead of, I guess it's kind of encouraging this, I guess, trend towards abstraction, I guess, because that's when abstraction, I think, was probably reigning the day, whatever. I'm not sure, but I don't know. How do you feel about that particular?
Well, yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about that. Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing is it seems so strange to say if black people would stop, and this is not exactly what you said, but they would stop focusing on blackness or black people, they'd be fine. Well, what about white artists?
Right.
Aren't they paint white people all the time. Is that their flaw?
Right.
Or, you know, it seems like that quotation is telling us more about the speaker than, of course, about the subject.
Exactly.
That it's showing their discomfort with, oh, now I have to see art with black people in it. Yeah. This makes me uncomfortable. But I think it also reminds me, there's a quote by, that I'll paraphrase, by Johann Winckelmann, who's considered the father of art history. And he said that the reason why Africans, who's speaking specifically about Egyptians, could never exceed in the visual arts was because they were limited by their own ugliness.
Oh, my goodness.
So he said, you know, the Greeks, beautiful people, beautiful art. All right, I'm not going to argue with that, but I'm not going to say that they're the only beautiful people who can make beautiful art.
Right.
But that was it. It was kind of in our physiognomy. It was in our visual appearance, and we couldn't ever get away from that to actually understand what beauty was. Which was fascinating to me because that immediately puts limits on who can be an artist and who sure. can be taken seriously and who yeah. can't. So, there's a lot of anxieties, I think, in controlling these racial boundaries of artistry. And I'm so glad that you're bringing up David Driscoll because I could talk about him all day. He's been such an important influence in my life. And I remember there was a book signing at your gallery where we stood in line and I got to introduce him to my mother for the first time. It was such a wonderful, you know, moment to say, this is one of my mentors and he's, you know, and they immediately hit it off. And
excellent.
Yeah, I miss him. So many of us miss him so much, but you know, he was one of those great orators who had this knowledge, lived experience and study, a scholar, a curator, an artist,
yes.
an institution builder, you know. And he's an example of the kind of person you really have had to be if you're going to be African-American, promoting African-American artists. You know, you have to write, you know, and you know this, you have to have the gallery, you have to meet the artist, you have to publish the books, sure. you got to do the podcast, you know.
Absolutely.
Don't just get to do one thing.
No, exactly, yeah. exactly. So. And he mentions that, and his mentor, James Porter, was the yes. same way. And I remember David specifically mentioning the absolute reverence and respect he had for James Porter, who was an artist just like David was. Mm-hmm. An artist, a person that wrote modern Negro art
That's
in 1940,
right.
which was, as he put it, it was necessary. He didn't, I think the baton he passed to David was partly saying, listen, we don't have the luxury of only being an artist. We have to actually talk about it, critique it. And anyway, it was just an important transition from almost obscurity into where we are today.
It's absolutely true. And that, you know, the book that that David Driskell wrote, The Catalog for Two Centuries of Black American Art, that became a textbook really for a generation.
Oh, sure.
I think that book and Simela Lewis's volumes of African American artists.
Absolutely.
You know, and it was like, we're going to have to do this ourselves.
Yes. And when you rewind the clock, think about it. I mean, you mentioned Aline Locke and the Negro in Art, and then you got Modern Negro Art by James Porter, then Two Centuries by David Driskell, and the books by Simela Lewis on African-American art.
Right.
I mean, those form the foundation
that we
stand on to pursue from there. They told us about the curated art exhibits about mm-hmm. these various very important artists.
I absolutely agree. And I would say another name, I mean, someone who's younger, but Deborah Willis has been just nonstop with the, you know, the photography, the exhibitions, and then the multiple books. And then she's asked to write a foreword for everybody else's book, you know, that yes. has anything to do with Black people in photography. But when I first went to graduate school, and I went to the art library and I looked up African-American art, you know, to do some research. All of the books were by Deborah Willis.
Oh, my goodness.
And then I had to reach out to her and say, you know, hello, my name is Bridget Cooks and I'm a graduate student. And
was she receptive?
Yeah, you know, the way the story went is there was a conference at MIT. This was probably 93 or 94. Called Black Women in the Academy. And this is before the internet. And I had this experience of finding her books, and then they have at these conferences, these book rooms, you know, and you go and there's all these vendors and publishers. And I found the table where they were selling some of her books. And I'm chatty, and so I said, oh, I'm so excited about this woman. And they said, oh, she's here. She was just at the table just wondering how the books were selling. And I said, really? She's here? So I said, oh, that's so great. And then I walked away, and then a minute later I said, I'm going to leave a note for her on the message board. We have these message boards, right? Because there's no text messaging or cell phones or anything. I said, if she comes back, would you tell her to look for a note to her on the message board? They said, okay. So that's where I wrote on the stationery that I had, I think you're amazing. Can I talk to you? And I was 20 or 21. I mean, I was really young. Mm-hmm. And about 2 weeks later, she called me, and she invited me to apply for an internship at the National African American Museum Project, to which I said yes. And, I was so nervous. I remember when I answered the phone, I was blasting Sly and the Family Stone, and I thought it was a friend, you know, and I was like, hey, you know. And Deborah has that, you know, that super sexy voice. She's like, hello, this is Deborah Will. I'm like, oh no. So I remember like
scrambling, you know, for the volume knob.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, this is when phones had cords.
Right.
So I had the phone and I'm trying to get to the other side of the room. And yeah. But she really took me under her wing. You know, she's very hands off. You have to tune in and really listen to everything she says and mm-hmm. then take the directive and don't mess it up.
Okay.
And I've learned so much from her, you know, because she's so, for a generation of women, maybe even more, she has been such a model of just doing your work, but making way for other people, giving other people opportunities, inviting them to be a part of a book or a talk or a series of some kind, and giving you your break. Mm-hmm. And David was her mentor. So yeah, I've been very privileged to work with and, you know, benefit from, be mentored by some amazing
That's fantastic.
It's an amazing lineage of people.
It just reinforces the idea of the importance of mentorship.
It really does. Yeah. It's so important. And it's something very special mm-hmm. also. So, and you have to be a good mentee, you know.
Sure.
And I didn't always make the right choices. I think I remember that Deb invited me to be part of a book, and I didn't have enough confidence to do it. Mm. And I didn't write anything.
Oh.
And now, of course, it's like, yes, when do you need it, you know. But she didn't sort of say she's not ready for anything. It was like, well, she didn't do that, but let me see if she'll pick up the mantle and do something else. So, you know, she, I think, saw something in me that she could work with. I just adore her.
Fantastic. Well, that's kind of a nice segue into what are you working on now? I know you're teaching outside from teaching in terms of writing.
Well, let's see. A book that I've been working on for some time is on Norman Rockwell's civil rights paintings.
Ah, interesting.
Very unexpected, I think. Mm-hmm. Not a follow-up to Exhibiting Blackness, but I've been really interested in art from the civil rights movement, in part following the clues from Kelly Jones, who needs to be mentioned, who had this great exhibition called Witness at the Brooklyn Museum of Art from the 1960s, art about the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a Norman Rockwell painting, an integration painting. I think it was The Problem We All Live With from 1963, with a little black girl who's walking past this wall. Yeah.
And I've seen that image. What a powerful image.
Yes, very powerful.
You don't see the faces of the marshals escorting her. You just see her. She's just a little girl.
She's just a little
cute
girl.
Little girl trying to go to school and has to be guarded by these marshals.
That's right. It's a very powerful painting. And so Norman Rockwell made four paintings about integration in the 1960s, racial integration. So this book looks at each of those paintings in separate chapters. Mm. And within the context of Look magazine, which Look is the entity that commissioned him to make the work. So that's been really fun to do research on. I have been slowed down by many invitations to write for catalogs. I have an essay coming out in the Bob Thompson retrospective that's going to be opening. It'll be close to here at the Hammer.
Oh, fantastic.
I have an essay in a really wonderful exhibition catalog for an exhibition called Supernatural America that Bob Cozzolino in Minneapolis has organized, has curated.
Uh-huh.
I just wrote a catalog essay for a Faith Ringgold retrospective that's opening at the new museum called Faith Ringgold American People.
Oh.
And I'm this month, I'll be writing an essay for an exhibition about a black artist named Mike Henderson, who taught at UC Davis. And then there's also going to be a kind of redo of the Deluxe Show that happened in Houston in 1971. And I'm writing an essay for that catalog.
If you just wouldn't mind, what was that about, the Deluxe?
Yes, this is such a fascinating story. So there was a show called The Deluxe Show in Houston in 1971, which was curated by Peter Bradley, who's an African-American artist who's in New York. He's an abstract painter and sculptor. And this was the first interracial black and white and one Latinx artist, Virginia Jaramillo, the first interracial group of abstract artists in an exhibition in America.
Wow.
It happened in Houston. It was in a theater that was called the Deluxe Theater, and that's why it was called the Deluxe Show. Yeah. In a black neighborhood, the theater has since been torn down.
Oh, that's sad.
It didn't reflect the community. Community art. It wasn't figurative. It was definitely kind of like a New York ABEX show in this, financially struggling working class black neighborhood. in Houston. And so it was an interesting show to research and write about. Peter was very generous in sharing his stories about putting the show together, working with the different artists. Clement Greenberg, the great 20th century critic of abstract art, was involved in the show, wrote for the catalog, was at the opening.
Wow.
And it's just kind of an interesting blip in American history, but thinking particularly about abstraction and Black artists. The work in the show was very strong, but it didn't make any sort of, it made its point, I think, by saying, look at, the racial boundaries don't make sense,
right.
But it didn't make, and it's to no fault of the show, it didn't make a change, you know, in terms of future exhibitions.
I see.
Yeah.
So, and was it associated with any museum, or was it just all on its own?
Yeah, Peter worked for a gallery in New York called Pearl's Gallery. And but this was a show that he wanted to do. He was asked by, this is, I guess, the museum connection. The Manils invited him to do this exhibition of the Manil collection in Houston.
I see.
But it wasn't at the Manil collection at all. It was in the community, but they supported it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see.
So the show's being revisited. There's work from the exhibition and then work by the same artists that are more recent and other works from the time period as well.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So that's what I've been writing about. I'm also associate director of a new museum that's opening at UC Irvine, the Institute and Museum of California Art. And I have a show that's opening, a group show called Dissolve, that will open in February.
Oh, fantastic.
That I'm really excited about. It's a really fantastic group of people led by Kim Conatani, who we stole from the Guggenheim, who's wonderful, who used to work at MoCA in early days. And, it's a small staff who have great ideas, who all get along with each other, who are trying to build a real consortium of California museums to work together, to share collections, to make loans easier, to share ideas.
I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, and really founded on the gift of two collections, the Gerald Butt Collection and the Irvine Museum Collection that was given by Jim Swindon. So we are excited about what's coming next. I'm honored that Kim asked me to curate an exhibition, and we have our first two commissions for the IMCA. So that's something I'm really looking forward to.
Well, congratulations. That's fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll all be looking forward to that. And am I right? The museum itself is getting a new facility that's going to be coming sometime in the future, right?
Sometime in the future, yes. We're hoping in the next 5 or 6 years that there will be a brand new building. For now, we're in a space called the Von Karman Gallery, which was formerly the Irvine Museum in Irvine on Von Karman.
Okay.
So that's where the shows will be until there's a permanent space.
Okay.
So it's a huge endeavor. And it's the state of California, so there's a lot of
a lot of hoops to jump through, so
boy.
To speak.
Yeah, a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of offices that have to sign off, and yeah. But we're committed to it, and I think it'll be great.
Well, that's exciting. It'll be a benefit to all of us in
California
and beyond, people coming in from outside of the state.
I think so.
Well, that's fantastic. And besides that, any other curatorial projects coming up?
Well, let's see. I have an exhibition that's touring right now called The Black Index. And it's an exhibition of six artists who have made work that really reflects our moment right now of dealing with a kind of normality of white supremacy, a normality of Black death, and how we survive and even thrive despite these dire political circumstances that we find ourselves in.
Yes.
So Alicia Henry, Lava Thomas, Kenyatta A.C. Hinkle, Titus Kaphar, Dennis Delgado, and Whitfield Lovell are the six artists in the show. It's kind of an all-star cast. Very nice. Many of them made work just for the show. They really believed in the theme and the idea behind it. So it opened at UCI, unfortunately, during COVID, and very, very, very few people got to see it. But it's open at the Palo Alto Arts Center right now through August 14th. Then it's going to UT Austin.
Okay.
And then it
will... That may be Texas?
In Texas, okay. Yeah. And then it's going to the Hunter College Art Galleries in January.
And that's in New York.
Right? In New York. Yeah. And then when that show closes in April, I have a solo show of Lava Thomas's work that's opening at the Montgomery Museum of Fine Art.
And where is that?
In Montgomery, Alabama.
Oh, wow.
And okay. She's done, there'll be three bodies of work, but the main feature body is called Mugshot Portraits, the women of the Montgomery bus boycott. Oh, wow. Where Lava has, and I have three of these in the Black Index, but Lava has made 15 of these drawings, slightly larger than life, based on the mugshots of Black women who participated in the boycott. And so this is a really historic opportunity to show those portraits in Montgomery. So the show's called Lava Thomas Homecoming. Wow. And I'm really
delighted. That sounds interesting and exciting.
It's really interesting and exciting. And we've been making contact with some of the family members, inviting them to be part of the audio tour to tell us about their relatives. I just think it's going to be really a very moving even spiritual kind of moment where people can meet Lava, we can meet the family members, and we can really focus on the individual women as women and not as just criminals, you know?
Right. Criminals for protesting about unfair treatment and
exactly.
discrimination and so forth.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. But we only know about Rosa Parks
right.
broadly, and we know some of us about Joanne Robinson, who was the main organizer. Yeah. Of the mass action. So this is an opportunity to learn more about the everyday radicals.
I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
And when did you say that'll be?
So that opens on April 30th of 2022.
All right, I'm going to have to mark that down. Everybody, please.
Please come to that.
Check that out.
Yeah, it'll be up through July 24th.
Okay.
And we'd love to travel it. So we'll see if that's possible.
I hope it does travel. That would be a great benefit for everyone.
I think so. Yeah. So I have a lot of exciting things going on. It's so funny. Usually people say, what do you have going on? And I am able to get through one and they think I'm done. So this is great to talk about like all six things that I'm doing between the writing and the curating. So I appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it. And I'm sure all the listeners and viewers are going to appreciate it as well. We'll look forward to all of that.
Thank you.
Well, listen, I just want to thank you once again for joining us and for sharing your perspective. And for everyone out there for listening and viewing, please don't forget to subscribe to Eric's Perspective. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.